This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have a great conversation with FlightAware founder and CEO Daniel Baker. In the news, we look at the Dubai Air Show, aviation cybersecurity, the proposed Women in Aerospace Education Act, the GE Additive 3D Metal Printer, and a report from the Senate Republican Policy Committee on ATC privatization. All that and a lot more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 479 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined first by Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's also a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening. And you know what I just thought of when you said that? 479. That means there's only 21 left until we hit 500.
That's right. 500 might line up pretty well with 10 years as well. They'll be pretty close. We'll have to think of something to do for that. I guess that's kind of a major milestone. But also joining us this episode is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. How, everybody? I'm in a bit of a turmoil because I'm in the middle of my move, if most people don't know, but I'm leaving my beloved Philadelphia International Airport and moving on to greener pastures. So I drove back to my existing apartment where the cable wireless is, and then tonight after I'm done, I will drive back to where my bed is. So I'm sort of living between two places.
But for next episode, you should be in your new apartment, all set up there with the studio.
Oh, Lord, I hope so, but I'm not betting on Comcast anything.
Okay. Also with us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. Hope all's well, and looking forward to a great show tonight.
Yeah, I think it's going to be terrific. We've got a great guest, but before we introduce him, we have to introduce the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of the Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI and a glass cockpit expert. Max T, how are you?
Max, I'm excellent, and I just wanted to say happy Thanksgiving to you and our listeners around the world. And Rob, are you saying that after all these years, we're finally going to be batting 500? Is that what you're saying?
Well, actually, we're pretty close. Yeah, I think it's about time, don't you?
It's about time we get it more than half right. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
All right. Well, here to help us get it right this episode is our guest, Daniel Baker. He's the founder and chief executive officer of FlightAware, the flight tracking data company that provides over 10,000 aircraft operators and service companies, as well as over 12 million passengers with global flight tracking solutions. Now, Daniel was originally one of the principal developers of the FlightAware technology, and he now works directly with partners and customers in both industry and government. Daniel knows tech, and he's been in the internet services business for over two decades. He speaks at aviation and technology conferences. He serves as a member of the board of directors at the Smithsonian Institute's National Air and Space Museum, which, of course, you all know, we have a soft spot for that museum. He also holds an FAA commercial pilot certificate. So, Daniel, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, FlightAware is just a couple of years older than this podcast. FlightAware was founded, I believe, in 2005.
That's right.
Has the vision changed over the years?
It has, because the vision originally was for private pilots and for sort of the owner-operator type of pilot who was maybe flying a Cessna around town or going to see friends and family, just to have a way to track their flights and a way to tell friends and families to track their flights. And so when I started it, there was no commercial motivation whatsoever. There was no business plan. It was purely a hobby. And I worked with the FAA to get a data feed of flight plans and departure, arrival information, radar data, all that jazz. And I worked with some friends of mine, and we put together this website, FlightAware, that had this just that simple purpose of letting people be track IFR flights and provide a transparent interface into the air traffic control system. And so there was no plan really beyond that, but it wasn't long after the website launched that people started calling, whether it be airports, flight departments for corporate Part 91 operators, to charter companies, airlines, FBOs. And it was really clear that this was the type of technology that people really wanted and didn't have access to. And so we went from it being just a hobby to essentially, you know, I get paid to do what I was doing for free on the weekends anyway, which is a pretty good deal.
All right. Well, I think most of our listeners are familiar with FlightAware, and we'll look forward to digging into it in some detail. I think there's some interesting aspects to the technology that's employed and what's happening in that space. But first, we've got some aviation news to talk about from the past week. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yep.
Ready from the West.
We'll kick it off by talking about the Dubai Air Show recently concluded. We have a number of different articles covering different aspects of the show, and those will all be in the show notes. But Airbus and Boeing, I think, to a large extent, kind of stole the show, at least with the size of the orders that they booked, or at least the orders that they announced at the air show. Fly Dubai from the UAE ordered 175 Boeing 737 MAX planes with options for another 50. Boeing said that was the biggest order ever from the Middle East for single-aisle passenger planes. Across the 225 firm and option aircraft, they have a total value of $27 billion at list price. Of course, as we've commented previously, list price doesn't mean a whole lot, so the actual price is going to be somewhat less than that. Airbus said that they reached a deal to sell 430 A320neo jetliners worth roughly $50 billion, again at list prices, to Indigo Partners. Now, Indigo owns several low-cost airlines, things like Wizz, Frontier, Volaris, and JetSmart. And that's a order for a combination of A320neos and A321neos. So that's a big order for Airbus, which, as some of the press reports note, the sales chief at Airbus, John Leahy, is about to retire. So this kind of caps or puts a nice cap on a fairly productive career. But, you know, just when we thought that orders for airliners couldn't get any greater than the backlog we already have, we see these big, big orders coming in. So it's big news, big time, good times for single-aisle aircraft especially.
Yeah, these numbers are just massive.
They are. I mean, I don't think anybody can deny that. I mean, I've never seen anything like this before. But, of course, doesn't it make you wonder that maybe after Leahy leaves, there'll be an email that says, "Just kidding." You know, I don't know. I'm just wondering. But
I was at an event a couple of years ago where John Leahy spoke, and I thought, "Oh, this will be interesting," and kind of interested in his perspective. And I got to tell you, the guy is an incredible salesperson. And by the time I was done listening to his 45-minute presentation, I wanted to buy an Airbus. I mean, it was just it was really compelling. So I could believe that an airline is actually in the market for an airliner would get pretty excited as well.
And you know what I think is interesting, too, is that we see these massive orders for airplanes. And despite the people on this show that think that drones are going to take over the world, there are still some of us that believe in manned aircraft. And I just happen to be working on another story today. And I saw this Boeing study that said that in the next 20 years, they expect the need to be 637,000 pilots around the world. And the numbers, it's almost as if the airlines around the world have been doing nothing for the last 20 years, but there are an awful lot of people retiring and an awful lot of old airplanes are going to be put out to pasture.
And and are there a lot of people training to become pilots? If you look at the demographics.
Not as many as we'd like. Not as many as the industry seems to think it's going to need. And there are still people that say, oh, I don't want to be a pilot. It's too expensive and I won't make any money. So
those are real problems.
Yeah. Oh, they are. And it's, of course, it's not just this industry. My wife's in the healthcare industry too. And she has seen the same kinds of things, with young people saying, I don't want to do that kind of work. And there are a lot of industries like that, but anyway, building airplanes certainly seems to be a good deal for the Airbus folks. I wonder how many of those are going to build in Alabama.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Airbus is certainly diversified. We have Alabama. Airbus is also building planes in China. And I think that's part of a really intelligent strategy for Airbus. But I don't know where these are going to be built. There wasn't any A380 action, really. I think some people expected an Emirates order for more A380s, but that didn't happen.
But did you see? That was right on the brink.
Yeah.
Apparently, they had the press conference all ready to go, and just moments before, Emirates said, "Nah, we're not sure we're ready to move forward on this." So that one was a lot of brinksmanship there. They thought they were going to get that order.
It's an interesting game that gets played, and sometimes the order can be, or the deal can be, really finalized between the parties well in advance of an air show like Dubai or Farnborough or Paris, where they want to make an announcement. And then there are other situations where it really is right down to the wire. I think Emirates is a pretty sharp cookie when it comes to negotiating, and they know how to make their point, I think. And I guess they did this time.
Yeah, well, certainly placing an order for 40 787s instead of the A380s, that's a huge point.
And they've been looking for a 10-year commitment, I guess, that Airbus will continue to build the A380, and they haven't gotten that yet. So I think they may be trying to leverage Airbus a little bit. We may still hear of that A380 order. clearly, I can't talk. A380 order later in the year.
Yeah, that's possible. There's an interesting chart in, well, one of the Bloomberg articles that comes from the Airbus forecast. And this is the single-aisle planes that are expected to be in demand through 2036. And single aisle is 73%, which is a big percentage. Twin aisle, about a quarter, and very large planes, which I guess is the A380, is just a very small sliver, maybe more than just A380s, but very large planes, just a small sliver. But single-aisle planes over that time period, 24,807. That's a lot of airplanes.
Yeah, everyone gets so excited about the huge airplanes and all the innovations there. But really, all the demand is in the workhorse that really doesn't get too much attention.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Sometimes companies get kind of, like you say, caught up in the sort of the glamour of the big iron. But it is the single-aisle, the smaller planes, maybe some aircrafts that are sometimes less glamorous than the big stuff.
Yep, everyone talks about Global Express and G650, but you go to an FBO and there's a lot of King Airs coming and going.
Yes. There was another interesting deal that was done. This is with Azerbaijan Airlines, and this deal was valued at $1.9 billion. This was for Boeing 787-8 aircraft as well as two freighters. But the interesting thing with Azerbaijan is that they become this launch customer for the 787 Landing Gear Exchange Program. Now, this is an overhaul, an exchange program. It's kind of simple in concept. The air carrier, the aircraft operator, can exchange landing gears for others from a pool that are already repaired and overhauled. So you remove the landing gear that need maintenance, and you kind of swap them out with another set provided by Boeing. And that's sometimes called a rotable pool, but it's a really effective way for an operator to kind of, you know, manage the operation, not have to worry about the maintenance aspect and scheduling it and making sure they have enough spares on hand and that sort of a thing. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And Azerbaijan kicks off that program.
Sounds like a way to get better utilization of the aircraft. If you can just swap the landing gear faster and keep that thing flying to earn revenue. Are there other airliners, OEMs that have offered that in the past? It was news to me.
I'm familiar with it from an engine standpoint, so that engine OEMs will at times offer these rotable pools, an exchange program, if you will, to operators. Sometimes it's for parts. It could be a set of fan blades, or it could be an entire engine module, so that you just swap out the module that needs maintenance, ship that off to the service provider who sends you another one, slap it on, and, you know, off you go. Typically, those things are done for sort of a fixed fee. It may be a cost per flight hour or some other kind of arrangement. So, yeah, they do occur on the engine side. I'm not sure about other airframe components or sub-assemblies, but I think it's entirely possible. One other, we talk about supersonic planes from time to time, and, of course, back in episode 463, we had Blake Scholl on, the founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic. And he was at Dubai trying to woo investors, get some Middle East airlines looking at his supersonic plans and get them to sign up for some interest. He tells us that the business plan contemplates 1,000 or 2,000 Boom aircraft over the next 10 years, which is that's a large number. But he does have some orders on the books, and you know he's continuing to move forward with that program. I think I'm very, very curious to see how well that succeeds.
It's going to be great to have a supersonic aircraft back in the air again in commercial service if that really happens. And he's saying first aircraft entering service in 2023. I mean, that's barely 5 years, so we'll see if he makes it.
Yeah. Blake says he's got 76 pre-orders from the airlines, and he's talking to quite a large number, maybe as many as 20 other carriers about possible deals. So
have they publicized who any of these carriers are for the 76?
I don't think so. Of course, that would be incredibly interesting to learn. I think that's being kept close to the vest at this point.
Yeah, then I'd know who to buy a ticket on.
And then we did see a little bit of C-Series action. Egypt Air signed a letter of intent, 12-firm Bombardier CS-300 C-Series, 12 on option. So small order, but nice to see Bombardier generating some sales.
And there were also some orders for some freighters as well, so we can't ignore the freight dogs here.
That's right. Okay, moving ahead, cybersecurity report fears dismissive approach. This comes from AIN Online. There's a think tank, a Washington think tank called Atlantic Council, and they've released a report that's titled Aviation Cybersecurity Finding Lift, Minimizing Drag. I guess someone got a little bit clever with that. But this report, which is underwritten by Talas, thinks that ICAO, that their assessment on cybersecurity threats to ADS-B is a bit, well, quote, dismissive. And they say this: the study says that the aviation industry will likely experience cybersecurity challenges similar to other industries that have embraced the digital revolution. Previously, aviation systems were relatively secure due to the bespoke nature of their design, isolation from other systems, and little in the way of communication protocols. But air traffic management is no longer isolated, and ground services and supply chains are becoming fully integrated into an interconnected digital world. Also, they say, in addition, cyber adversaries and their capabilities evolve and adapt quickly. So this is kind of an interesting topic. Daniel, when we talk about ADS-B, those communications, are they all unencrypted, and is that a problem?
Yeah, that's right. Everything's unencrypted, and it sort of points to a broader issue in aviation, which is that the release cycle is incredibly long, meaning the period of time that something will be in production until the next time there's a release and then actual adoption in aviation is decades, right? So we still have tons of aircraft that are Mode C before Mode S was adopted, and an incredible number of even jet aircraft that are Mode S and not ADS-B. And the standard DO-260B that's being adopted for ADS-B has been out for quite a while and will be permitted to be used and used in airplanes for at least 10 or 20 years, if not longer. And so the challenge is not just how you secure it, but how do you actually get these changes throughout the world's fleet? And to the point in the article, a lot of these legacy systems are now connected to the internet, and there's no question that aviation will be impacted by this. And I think one of the big changes that we've seen perhaps over the last few years is that for a long time, the biggest security targets were things that have had a financial motive or a financial upside, so whether it be banks or financial institutions, or getting information that could be acted upon to make money, or e-commerce sites where you could either get products and not pay for it, or use identity theft in different ways. That there was always a financial motive, and there isn't really a tremendous financial motive in aviation, and particularly around air traffic management and ADS-B. But if you look at state-sponsored cyber attacks, where their goal might be either getting information or disruption, this has been a concern that people have talked about with a lot of the public utilities and the electrical grid, and I think that air traffic is no different in that sense.
Yeah, the long lead time part of this is scary to me anyway, in that not only would it take a while to think about what kinds of changes might make sense in terms of increasing the security of these systems, but just getting that out, getting that hardware out, getting that software out so that you affect that change is probably years and years away.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that in the case of ADS-B, for example, there's certainly some risks out there, but the systems that the government uses, and actually even that flight aware use, are more sophisticated than a single receiver. And so you can actually, what they call multilaterate or triangulate a signal that's being received from an ADS-B target. And so a reasonably sophisticated receiver of that data can know if the message that it's getting is potentially valid. But then you run into the problem of, if it requires all this additional infrastructure and the ability to multilaterate the signal, are we actually able to get all of the benefit and cost reduction that we anticipated out of it if we have to have a lot of additional infrastructure to validate the data? But as it relates to ADS-B, the goal is that every airplane and maybe even drone has the ability to emit its position, right? And so how would you ever solve that problem? Because it's not like it's a private communication between two parties. It's everyone with a drone and an airplane needs the ability to emit their position. So there's no way that you're ever going to get away from everyone is able to broadcast, because the protocol has to be out in the public.
Right. In other words, just encrypting those transmissions doesn't do anything for you. I mean, in fact, it defeats the whole purpose of the system to begin with.
That's right.
And so there has to be other solutions if in fact we're vulnerable.
That's right. And so I think that, certainly we have the smart people, and we can create the technology. And the question just is, in what decade will this be widely implemented?
Okay. Next item. This is kind of a local item, or at least it has a local flavor for me. This is from the New Haven Register. Connecticut's ESTE sponsors Women in Aviation Bill. Now, this is about H.R. 4254, the Women in Aerospace Education Act, introduced in Congress. And this is, quote, to amend the National Science Foundation Authorization Act of 2002 to strengthen the aerospace workforce pipeline by the promotion of Robert Noyce Teacher Scholarship Program and National Aeronautics and Space Administration internship and fellowship opportunities to women. And what this seeks to do is give sort of priority in the award of these scholarships and so forth, priority to women in an effort to, you know, strengthen the STEM content of education that and training that women receive in order to bring more of them into the industry. So at this point, it's just been introduced. It did, as I understand it, make it out of committee, which is a lot of bills never do make it out of committee. So I think the next step is for a floor discussion on this act. But I think this is encouraging. What do you guys think? Does this sound like something that ought to get some pretty broad support?
Well, it's nice that they're jumping on our bandwagon in supporting women in aviation. So it's nice to see the rest of the industry pick up on this.
I hadn't been familiar with this the Robert Noyce Teachers Scholarship grants, but these are used apparently by universities to cover the cost of STEM degree students who go on to teach in rural and low-income school districts. So it's very much, I guess, kind of a pipeline-filling activity. And then the NASA internship and fellowship opportunities, this act says that no later than October 1st, 2018, NASA shall institute a process to prioritize the promotion and recruitment of qualified candidates who are women or individuals who are historically underrepresented in fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, and computer science for internships and fellowships at NASA with relevance to the aerospace sector and related fields. This seems to have bipartisan support. We'll have a link in the show notes to how you can follow along at govtrack.us, and that allows you to see sort of the progress of this bill.
Should we define bipartisan for our listeners?
Do you want to take a stab at that?
No.
Okay. No. I mean, I thought that was when people from both sides of the aisle work together, but
what part of no don't you understand?
David's trying to stay out of politics, but that's exactly what it is. U.S. Representative Elizabeth Esty is a Democrat. This has also been sponsored by the Republican from California, Steve Knight. So we have both sides of the aisle working together to make this happen. We've talked about 3D printing, and Brian, you've got a 3D printer now. Have you been successfully manufacturing items with your 3D printing?
Certainly not for jets, but yes, I've made several prints at this point. I kind of equate the industry to be what the computer industry was in the late 70s, early 80s. It's definitely not a consumer friendly product yet, but you can do some pretty interesting stuff with it. And GE is now printing parts for jet engines.
They have a business unit, GE Additive is what they call the business unit doing this. And they've got a really large 3D metal printer now.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So one of the engines that they worked on, they took 900 separate components and combined it into 16. And so one part of the engine had 300 components, and they reduced that down to just one. And this is making the engine 40% lighter, 60% less expensive to produce. They've looked at the suppliers, where normally it would take 10 to 15 different suppliers to create all these parts. They now have that ability to create these components in-house. So huge savings for GE. And I find it just fascinating that through this additive process that they're able to make parts for the engine. And I think this area is just going to expand as the technology gets better.
So what are you using yours for? Are you going to be making like wider seats you can take with you when you fly in United?
Or the seat blockers so people can't recline their seat.
I
absolutely am not going to use it for that.
We actually use them at FlightAware for prototyping the designs for flight feeders, which are our ADS-B ground stations. And prior to the 3D printers, the engineers would design it on their computers and then have a local shop fabricate it. It was pretty expensive per iteration, and it was about a week turnaround from the design being sent to them to us getting the part back, and then we'd realize it didn't fit or it wasn't flush or it wasn't tight enough or something like that. And so this was a multi-month process versus now the case, for example, comes in two parts, the top and the bottom, and we can print one in, I think it's just a few hours. You have two printers side by side, so you print the top and the bottom separately. And so the engineers can iterate multiple times per day on the case, and then by the time it's finalized, we can just send the design to our manufacturing partner in China, and then they can ship thousands of them to us. So it's sped up the process incredibly and saved a ton of money. And we're just using relatively simple kind of consumer 3D printers, but the end result is just phenomenal.
It really, there's almost no downside to this. As you say, it's less expensive, it's faster, it's just almost no downside to it. Of course, when you're talking about printing, printing has, I put quotes around it because it's not really printing, but that's kind of the popular term for it. But when you're printing jet engine components, of course, they're going to be metal. And so in the case of this large new GE printer, it uses lasers, a 1 kilowatt laser to fuse metal powder in layers, and that's how you print the part. Now, this is a big machine. Currently, it will print parts up to a meter in diameter. GE says that the technology they're using here is scalable, so it could be enlarged to print even bigger parts. This is still kind of in beta. In fact, GE, I think, hasn't even named this printer yet. But yeah, the possibilities are just mind-boggling, and I'm sure any significantly sized aviation company is looking at this, if not using this technology already.
Yeah, and there are other techniques besides the laser that you can fuse the metal powder. So I find it truly fascinating how rapidly this industry is evolving and the quality of the items that they're able to produce.
Yeah, if you think about the parts on some of the light sport aircraft, you could definitely believe that we're not very far from even regular consumerly available 3D printers being able to produce those.
Yeah, when I first heard this story from the GE folks, they mentioned something about this at NBAA, and it just all kind of came out of the fog for me about, you know, taking the number of hundreds of parts down to just, you know, a dozen and a half. And, you know, and then the engineer that was explaining it said, and now, and for those of you that don't understand, and I went, oh, thank God he's going to explain it. You know, he said, and of course we're doing this now because we couldn't do it this way before, because we needed all these parts to put the darn thing together, because there was no way to build one, you know, I don't know, well, I can't say crankshaft, but, you know, to build some of these huge parts in one fell swoop. And now they can. And these guys were just so excited. It was as if Christmas had come early.
Yeah, you just couldn't cut things with the traditional machine tools because you couldn't get into some of the voids and spaces that were hard to reach. So, yeah, additive manufacturing is pretty cool. You could just literally build a single piece that years ago could not physically be made as a single piece because you didn't have the tools.
Yeah, I'll have to find a YouTube video for the show notes that shows how the printers are working with the laser to create the metal parts. It's really fascinating to watch.
Or you could show us a YouTube of what you've been making.
I could.
One final story from Flying Mag. And this is, Rob, you wrote this story. This is Senate Republican Policy Committee confirms ATC privatization is still alive.
Now, this is a really weird story. This Senate Republican Policy Committee makes, they essentially write white papers, short ones, about various and sundry issues, and I just happened to catch the topic. They called it next gen delayed, just like your airplane. And I went, oh, there's an opinion. So I thought, I've got to read this. And, you know, they kind of talked about ground radar is outdated and next gen's not coming along the way that it should, and there's not enough money there the way that there should be. And there are some people that don't support the updating issue, and then it just stopped. And I went, huh?
Yeah.
So what was the conclusion? And they really didn't have one, which I thought was kind of interesting, because in so many places they sounded like they were going down the road of Schuster's plan. And again, then it just stopped. And it sort of started out kind of political, talking about outdated, we've heard this before on the ATC issue about using radar that was designed in the 1940s. Well, of course, radar was designed in the 1940s. We airplane geeks know all that stuff. But it doesn't mean that the air traffic control system today is using the same radar that was created in the 1940s. I mean, the digital radar that they're using now is vastly more sophisticated than something that was even running 15 years ago. So again, it was just so strange that they went through all the work to make this supposed policy statement, and then it just stopped. And so I just wrote about it and said, this is pretty strange. And a lot of people, commented. And as one guy said, it's like the A4A, which is Airlines for America, kind of paraphrasing FAA. I'm here from the A4A, and we're here to help you. But the one fact I have to admit that I uncovered, and I did this all by myself. No, I'm just kidding. I had help from Max Trescout out on the West Coast about the fact that the airlines have, they've been beating everybody up about the lousy technology and next gen, and it hasn't kept up, and delays are, they imply the delays are because the technology's not there. And then we lo and hold, we find out that the airlines have an exemption for the 2020 ADS-B rule that all the rest of the people are going to have to follow. And I just found that fascinating. And what I thought was even more fascinating is that when the story ran, no one said a word about that.
Weren't a lot of the exemptions for the airplanes that are being retired shortly after the mandate comes into effect?
Well, it could be. The way it's worded in the document, it's very vague. It's very, very vague. And I said, I guess it kind of reads like this policy statement. But they give them until 24. The end of 2024.
So they got an extra 5 years.
That's a long time, to get, with the number of airplanes that are on order right now. That just seemed like an extraordinary time or amount of time to me to get this thing straight. But again, there just aren't really any answers, just a lot of interesting questions.
It does seem a little bit hypocrisy that the airlines want to take over ATC, but, oh, we don't want to have to necessarily pay for an updated GPS so that we can provide as accurate a position as required for everybody else who has to install ADS-B. So the other aspect I had read, Daniel, you mentioned perhaps aircraft are being retired. I had read that there were some new capabilities coming along that weren't going to be available, and so they were trying to delay having to do some type of interim replacement of their GPS because they knew something better was rolling along later.
That's always going to be the case, right?
Yep. Well, in terms, too, of retired aircraft, I mean, if they don't have the money to equip the airplanes that they have and they're planning on retiring them, 2 weeks or 3 weeks after the deadline, that's fine. But years later, I'd say tough.
Yeah, I was unaware the exemption was years. I was thinking months or maybe a year.
Oh, yeah. Well, at first when I saw it or I heard about it from Max, I thought, well, this can't be very long. And then when I saw that it was, 4 years, I thought, wow. But I was just surprised that nobody even commented on it. But Oh, well.
Yeah, that is kind of peculiar. But, Rob, I also thought this was kind of a strange policy statement in that it, gosh, I hate to use the word, but it almost seemed objective in some ways. I mean, they listed out, here are some of the reasons why people who believe ATC should be privatized think the way they do, and here are some of the reasons that people who don't want a privatized ATC use to make their argument. I mean, it lists both. But at the very end, kind of where I was, expecting, okay, so here's what we recommend, or here's the punchline. There wasn't the punchline. And instead, there was this thing about a Congressional Research Service report. It says that an ATC spinoff would very likely trigger constitutional challenges. All right, I hadn't heard this before. This report questioned, I'm reading from this policy statement, whether courts might determine that a non-governmental ATC corporation would be unconstitutional under the non-delegation doctrine, I don't know what that is, the due process clause, I don't even know what that is, or the appointments clause, another one I'm not familiar with. Although memoranda commissioned by proponents of a spinoff discount these concerns, the move to corporatize the ATC functions would almost certainly be challenged in court. So I thought that was very interesting. That's an aspect of this that I hadn't read about either. But it's an interesting policy statement. We'll have a link to this in the show notes so you can take a look at it yourself. It's certainly a fascinating read, I think.
Well, you know what I thought was funny is that at first when I read it, I thought, well, I must be missing a page here. And I thought, I don't see the next, I don't see the final page. So it's kind of like reading a novel and then finding out that someone took the last chapter.
Yes. But
there just wasn't any. And I thought, okay, why did they write this? And as you just mentioned, the gobbledygook in that CRS report, there was also a similar gobbledygook in the exemption for the airlines, which of course was, it just didn't happen. The A4A, the Airlines for America, petitioned the FAA for the exemption, and the FAA approved it. And so again, it's quite a few years. But the language, in fact, I sent it to Max Trescott. Max, were you ever able to understand exactly what it was saying? Because I certainly couldn't.
No, I couldn't. I didn't realize. I kind of read it and I was like, well, is this a rebuttal? It wasn't clear to me at all what they were saying.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's how they're doing it. They're, what is that, obfuscating?
Yeah, exactly.
Again, we're speaking with Daniel Baker. He's the founder and CEO of FlightAware. Daniel, again, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, there's some interesting, well, statistics, I guess, about the FlightAware data. FlightAware uses data from air traffic control systems in over 55 countries. It's a network of ADS-B ground stations in over 150 countries, and also some data from the Ariane space-based global ADS-B. Also data from other providers like Air Inc. and SETA and Satcom Direct, Garmin, Honeywell, even UV Data Link. There's a lot of data being pulled in. How do you do that? I mean, how do you pull in all this data and put it into a form that has value to the people using FlightAware?
Well, it's a really big challenge. When we first started, it was just the data feed from the FAA. And I actually wrote the original software that parsed that and turned it into the database and the information that you could access on our website. And I think parsing it is a really, you know, notable term here, which is that there wasn't a lot of intelligence around the system back then. If the FAA said a flight departed, then we said it was departed. And if it said the airplane's last position is here, then we indicated that's where the last position was. And it wasn't until we got our second data source, and you have hundreds now, but we got our second data source, and we said, well, this is a little bit tricky because we need to prioritize which data feed is more reliable because sometimes they'll disagree. And it didn't work that well, and there was it was hard to know, you know, what data source was best at what. And it wasn't until we got our third data source that we realized that it was just it was not an approach that was going to work. And so, you know, our developers now, who are much smarter than me, threw out what I wrote and invented a new system called Hyperfeed that actually takes all of these feeds in parallel, and it's not just parsing the messages and putting them through. It actually is keeping sort of what we call essentially a conscious awareness of airspace and what's going on. And it's taking all the data from different sources and not picking one piece and passing it through and throwing away another piece, but fusing it all together to create the best possible source of information. So we have about 1,000 rules and algorithms that our developers have written over the years, as well as some machine learning models to do some predictive technology. And so the challenge that we face and that Hyperfeed can now address is, if you have a flight, for example, from Paris to Los Angeles, with all of the different countries that are sending us data, we might be getting updates from the British ANSP and from Canada and from the US and potentially from Ireland and elsewhere. And all of these might be slightly different. And so rather than throw away certain data sources, Hyperfeed is aware of where the plane approximately is and, you know, who might have the best information on the current plane status, but it can piece together information along the way. So the U.S. might be assigning a new arrival, for example, but you wouldn't really want any information from the U.S. if the plane was over Ireland on what was going on the departure side. And it takes all of these sources together, along with the position sources from our ground stations and from Aireon Space Base ADS-B and radar in a bunch of countries, and it knows who has the best piece of information and who has contributing information, pieces it all together, and that's essentially what you're able to see on our website and the different interfaces that we have. And so right now, I think we're running about 10,000 messages per second through this engine. And if you think about 10,000 messages per second with over 1,000 rules, I mean, it's an incredible amount of computing power. And that's just on the processing side, not on the distribution as well. So we learned that what we wanted to do was more complicated than just taking a lot of data sources. And so the biggest value that we offer is our ability to take all this raw data, some of which is, you know, really valuable and some of less valuable, and produce something that can actually provide information and answer questions for the folks who are using FlightAware.
Daniel, why is some of the data inconsistent? Is it because different sources are trying to determine or calculate some particular data point and doing it independently of the others, and so they arrive at a different datum?
That's absolutely right. So you have a bunch of different air traffic control facilities that are calculating the ETA, but some are not aware of what happened before and the current time, and some are not aware of plans that other air traffic control facilities may have planned. We also run into situations where we'll have two or three different countries that are have their radar conducting surveillance on the airplane at once. And so radar is not as accurate as, for example, ADS-B. And so if you have three radar sites that are doing surveillance on an airplane, you're going to get three different positions all at once for an airplane. So FlightAware needs to know approximately where the airplane is and what radar facility it's closest to, and then rely on that. Another challenge that we get is that a lot of data is hand-entered, right, by air traffic controllers. So if you're flying, for example, to LAX, it wouldn't be uncommon that we might get a message from the FAA that says, well, here's a new routing, and the new destination is LAZ. And a lot of systems will say, oh, diversion and ETA, and here's all the changes. But FlightAware system will actually say, well, does that airport exist? Is the airplane orienting itself to that airport? Is the controlling facility controlling that that airplane? Is the airplane heading that way? And so it can actually say, well, let's throw this message in the back of the queue for 10 seconds and process it again. And so 2, 3, 4 seconds pass, it's processed another 40,000 messages. And it might get an update from the FAA that says, oh, new flight plan, it diverted to LAX. So you realize it didn't divert at all, right? Someone just made a typo. And then when that original message with the erroneous data comes back, our system has the awareness of something that happened afterwards. And so it can actually discard both of the messages and just, you know, keep on humming along. So it's having to deal with a lot of relatively low quality data, whether it be hand entered or transoceanic position reports or, essentially non-precision surveillance sources, and try and derive a lot of as much information as possible.
You use the term machine learning in it's kind of become a buzzword, I think, in some sectors. So when you talk about this ability to parse the data and determine what's the most accurate representation, is that what you mean when you talk about machine learning, or is that something different?
So the accurate representation would be the algorithms and the rules that the developers write. The machine learning models are around, largely at this point, around ETAs. And so what we can do is we can have machine learning models at large number of airports that watch not only a current flight, but airplanes that are in front of it and what routings they've taken, what approaches are in effect for an airport, are airplanes holding. And that's how we're able to derive things like ETAs for example, let's say you have an airplane that's 4 miles from an airport. A relatively dumb system would say, okay, well, let's divide the distance 4 miles by the ground speed, and there's your ETA. But using these models, we can actually look at what airplanes ahead of that have done. Have they passed and gone the other way, done two descending turns in the hold, and then joined maybe a downwind leg towards, along the approach to the runway. And those are the sort of things that are really key to being able to add a lot of value to the information. So it's both, Hyperfeed is both using a lot of algorithms to try and correct all this, but then also trying to add intelligence. And so we're never trying to just pass through data verbatim. It's really about what we can derive from knowing about the airspace, or what we can derive from the fact that we have a lot of different data sources.
Hmm. Where do you find people that understand this kind of technology, the developers that can implement this in the flight-aware software? Where do you find those folks?
Well, recruiting is one of the biggest challenges. And you know, from running the perspective of running a business, that was something that was a bit of a surprise to us, because we would often say, oh, we have a project and now we need, more folks, and who can we hire and when? And we had this really short time frame for when we needed people. We didn't realize that recruiting is maybe a 3, 6, 9, 12 month process, where you're maybe it's whether it be internships or networking or bringing people in and trying to interest them in what we're doing. But a lot of the background is in computer science or in math in particular, but it's not always in aviation. So a lot of folks who come to us, they are interested in aviation. We have a lot of pilots, and that's what made them aware of FlightAware in the first place. But for a lot of people, we're having to interest them in aviation. That's something that we're actually trying to address as well, which is, there's a lot of value in, for example, having flown an IFR flight, whether it be like, in the right seat and seeing it been done, or done a discovery flight or something like that. And so we're trying to see how we can expose more of these folks who are very, very smart, whether it be in math or computer science or both, to aviation, so they can be even more effective in what they're doing and experiencing it firsthand. Because, the National Airspace System and IFR routings and all that are incredibly complicated, but after you've done a few flights, you start to understand why things are what they are, and why things are happening that way.
So with the so-called ADS-B mandate, does that encourage you that there'll be more data available and that it can be incorporated into the FlightAware systems?
Yeah, absolutely. ADS-B has been terrific for us. We started probably 8 or 9 years ago building our own ADS-B receivers. And at the time, they probably cost us $3,000 or $4,000. And we could make one or two a month. And we were shipping them to different parts of the world to try and get coverage. And there weren't that many ADS-B equipped airplanes, but it was a fun project. We were exploring it. But now we can manufacture these flight feeder ground stations. We're shipping probably about 100 a week now. They're touchscreen Wi-Fi. They cost us less than $100. And one of these little orange plastic devices can pick up airplane signals for about 250 nautical miles line of sight and send it to us over the internet. And so we've got between people that have built their own or people that we've sent them to, probably 13,000-14,000 of these ground stations in 165 countries now. And we're providing this data to whether it be someone flying a 182 that wants friends and family to know exactly where he is with, high fidelity, to corporate flight departments, to charter companies, as well as a lot of the world's airlines. So probably have 10,000 aircraft that are paying us for this service that they're using globally, as well as all the folks who are, you know, tracking friends and family on United or Air France or whatever airline is emitting ADS-B. We can use that data to help provide a better service.
So you can build your own receiver with a Raspberry Pi, right? A PiAware.
Yep.
And then there's the flight feeder hardware. Is flight feeder kind of the pro model, or do they end up having about the same capabilities? What's the difference between PiAware and flight feeder?
Yeah, so the functionality is the same. So the PiAware is the open source version of FlightFeeder. It's the exact same software, and we make the parts available. FlightFeeder is where we assemble it, and we ship it to some part of the world where it's not likely that people are going to have the resources necessarily to build one. And the big difference would be if you have a PiAware, you're responsible for really setting it up and making sure all the parts work out, and then doing software upgrades on our web interface. Versus if it's a flight feeder, we're going to help with antenna placement and help do support, and we will remotely manage the device for you. And so one of the main reasons behind that is PiAware tends to be focused at folks who are very familiar with the technology, who want to tinker with it, who want to experiment, connect directly to it, either with the web interface or the data feeds that we give directly off the device. And flight feeder might be someone who's in a very remote part of the world who says, hey, I'll do this because it helps out and it's cool, but they don't necessarily want to get too involved. They may have never set up an antenna system before, or they may not really know, you know, too much about aviation and don't want to know too much about aviation. And so it's a little more of a self-managed, it's a little more of a FlightAware managed approach for the flight feeder. But the capabilities of the device are literally identical.
Hmm. Okay, interesting.
Well, you know, something I was going to ask, Daniel, is I noticed your partnership with the Aireon people. We've had Matt Desch on from Iridium number of times, and to talk about the technology. And of course, I think they're getting ready to do their fourth launch of satellites and all that. But so I know they're in the testing mode. So you guys are already in the testing mode with them to try to make sure all this data is coming down the way that it should be. Is would that be accurate?
Yep, that's right. So, of course, Iridium, one of the founders of a company called Aireon, which makes the space-based ADS-B receivers that are on each one of the Iridium NEXT satellites. And Aireon's model is largely focused on providing this data to air traffic control and air traffic management. And they're being very, very successful at doing that. A number of countries have signed on, and many countries are testing and evaluating it for surveillance over remote areas and over the ocean and elsewhere where surveillance is either tough or expensive. So they're doing a very good job at that. But we are a partner of theirs for providing this data in our flight tracking interfaces and data feeds and products for whether it be private aviation, cargo, airlines, all sorts of industries. And we're already getting data off of those satellites. So three successful launches at this point, and we've been receiving live data for a few months now, and the results are absolutely incredible. So we're getting positions from airplanes, whether it be over the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, the North Pole, places that we were never going to have terrestrial data. And it's really, really revolutionary.
Hmm. I can see how that would provide data over those remote areas, certainly. But what about overpopulated areas where you have other sources of data? Is the Aireon data unnecessary there, and you won't need to use it? Or how does that integrate with, or how will it integrate with the data sources that you have now?
Yeah, so we're really focused on just using the Aireon data in places where there isn't other coverage. Now, you know, Aireon's very, very high fidelity data and high frequency data they're providing to air traffic control. And one difference in the business relationship that we have with them versus air traffic control is that we're only taking their positions and providing them to our customers at one per minute, as opposed to many per minute, you know, every few seconds that they do for air traffic control. So what we're trying to do is say to an aircraft operator, you know, if you're over land, we can track your flights with our terrestrial or ground-based receivers. That's PiAware and Flight Feeder, and we'll do that 4, 5, 6 times a minute. And then when your airplane's over the ocean or over the desert or something, then we'll rely on the Ariane data and provide you one position per minute. And so that allows us to get the best of both worlds. And the beauty is that there tends to not be a lot of, the people aren't taking off and landing over the ocean, right? So the really high fidelity position tracking is less relevant. And we already have technology so that we send more positions when an airplane's doing something interesting and fewer when it's not. So if it's over the middle of the U.S. between Los Angeles and New York at 38,000 feet, we'll only be sending maybe to your map or your data feed a couple a minute. When it's at 10,000 feet or it's climbing or descending or turning, we speed that up quite a bit. That way we're not wasting bandwidth and computing power, but you're getting all the information that's useful.
And I would imagine that the satellite-based data probably has a higher cost than the other methods.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've collectively put billions of dollars into this infrastructure, and so the pricing on FlightAware reflects that. So we're going to continue to offer the free website as we always have been. We're continuing to expand the number of ground stations, and we're working on surface movement as well, so being able to track planes on the ground. And we're not changing the pricing of any of the commercial products, but for customers who want Ariane space-based ADS-B. The data from the Iridium Next constellation, then it's an additional charge, but it's optional. It just depends on if you're if you can actually benefit from it. So Qatar Airways was actually the launch customer last year. They signed up for it, both in a web interface and in a data feed. We have a number of other airlines that have signed. They're going to be announced soon. CETA is a partner of ours that provides currently FlightAware data in their flight tracking interface. And so they're actually selling the Ariane space-based ADS-B data as well. And their launch customer was Malaysia Airlines. And we've got a number of others all over the world who are pretty excited about it.
In terms of the business model, and I can imagine you might want to not go too deep into that, but in terms of the business model, are you self-sufficient, or is FlightAware working off of investor capital? How does that outlook appear?
Yeah, so FlightAware has been profitable for more than 10 years. It started in 2005 and became profitable in 2006. And so we've been really fortunate, even in the downturn, to do pretty well. We've got a variety of different business models, and the kind of goes back and forth. What's the going very well? We have the consumer advertising business, which is our very, very first business. And you see advertisements on our website, whether it be for consumer goods or financial services or airplane parts and or for aircraft, those sorts of things. So we do a lot of business in that realm. And then we've got products for both business aviation, for cargo, for passenger airlines, as well as for FBOs, for airport operators. So we have quite a few business lines, both web-based products and data reports, data feeds, those sorts of things. And so, you might be surprised, but if you were to go out and talk to some of the world's largest providers of aviation technology, whether it be Air Inc. or CETA or IBM, which owns the Weather Company, a bunch of these companies, and ask them for a flight tracking system, it's actually FlightAware that's powering that system behind the scenes, either providing the whole thing or just providing the data feed on where your fleet is. And so even if we don't have a direct relationship with an airline or an aircraft operator, there's a really good chance that they're using our systems behind the scene to run their operation.
Interesting. Maybe just mention this briefly, FlightAware TV and what that's all about.
Yeah, so we have a really cool, we might call it TV-based flight tracking system. And for years, people were saying to us, hey, we want, whether it be in our lobby or in our hangar, a beautiful FlightAware map and arrival and departure information. And we were really reluctant to get into the hardware business and say, we're going to provide to you this appliance that you plug into your TV, because we're not a hardware company, and that wasn't something that we were really confident that we'd do a good job of. And the technology has advanced a bunch. And so, in fact, we now offer this sort of technology, but in a web browser. So what we say to people is, find an old laptop and take that, plug it into your TV, go to this special URL, And we now have an animated interface where it will update the map, zoom in and pan around and show your airport or your fleet, show all the live flight data on the side, sort of like a much prettier version of what you might see in an airline terminal where it tells you your gate information and that sort of thing.
You know, I have a question for you, Daniel. I mean, since I'm a user of FlightAware, one topic that comes up at some of our airport board meetings is the fact that the tail numbers on some of the airplanes that use the airport is the numbers are blocked.
Right.
I wonder if you could just explain a little bit about that so that some of our listeners might have a better idea of how that works or doesn't work.
Yeah, so we basically allow any aircraft operator to come to us and say, hey, we don't want our flight data displayed on your website, whether it be for privacy reasons or security concerns or anything. And we can remove their tail number from the website so that information isn't publicly disclosed. Now, in the early days of FlightAware, that was an FAA requirement. And they said, well, you know, you can have all the FAA flight data, but you need to not show data for this list of operators. And they still operate that program. But we've expanded it a bit so that in light of ADS-B and people flying in areas well outside of the FAA's jurisdiction to allow people to fly without their whereabouts being available on the internet. So that's a free service. You can call or email and we can help you with that. But we also offer a service called FlightAware Global and Selective Unblocking, where for those aircraft operators, if they want to control who has access and say, well, I don't want it on the internet, but I want these 10 people to know where my plane is and have access to that data, we can, for a fee, provide that that service to them. And then we provide the same to FBOs. So FBOs can say, I'm sorry, aircraft operators can say, well, I don't want anyone to see my data except for these 10 people. And I'd also like FBOs to know when I'm arriving or departing from their facility, because they're going to see my airplane anyway. They're going to know that I'm there, and they need to be prepared to provide ground support. And so an authenticated FBO, and that's a free service as well, although we do have paid services for FBOs, can see that either a blocked airplane is coming or going, or can actually see the tail number. So we provide a lot of different options around being able to both conceal your data or provide it to whoever you need.
Mm, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Well, Daniel, interesting, very interesting conversation. FlightAware, of course, it's easy to find FlightAware online, right? The website is flightaware.com. Also, same on Facebook and Twitter, correct?
That's right. Yep, absolutely. And if you know you're interested in building your own ground station or seeing how the ADS-B network has evolved, you can look at flightaware.com/ADS-B and see the open source software, what parts you'd need to build your own kit. And you can build a ground station for under $100 and see the data directly off that device and see what's flying over your house. Or if you have line of sight to an airport, see airplanes taxiing around on a map. So it's really cool.
Yeah, I've thought about that. David always bugs me about how many Raspberry Pis I have laying around here, and I really have thought about building PiAware or something similar to that. Maybe I'll have to do that someday.
Yeah, absolutely. If you've got a Raspberry Pi, that's basically half the expense. All you need is we call a FlightAware Pro Stick, which is less than $20. Plug that in there, and you'll be receiving 1090 megahertz or 978 ADS-B.
Yeah, what kind of view of the sky do you need?
So it's all line of sight. So the more that you can see the sky, the better. But if it's obfuscated, then you'll see, you know, if you're only able to see maybe south out of your window or from your rooftop, you'll only see south. You could always get two ground stations, but one on one window and one on another window, and be able to see both directions.
Wait a minute. Do you mean to tell me that this works through the window, that I do not need to stand on the roof of the building with the antenna in my hands like I've been doing to make this work?
The higher you are and the better visibility, then yeah, that's the best. That's the best.
Because that's what Bryce told me to do. He said to get the best reception to go up on top of the roof.
That is true, but that is not mandatory. And you can put it by the window and it'll work reasonably well.
Okay. And for listeners, that's an inside joke, so.
Okay. Daniel Baker, thanks so much for being on the podcast. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and our listeners.
Thanks so much. Happy to do it anytime. It was a lot of fun.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Rob, let's start with you. Anything new aviation-wise in your world?
Oh, yeah. I finally got tired of listening to Max West talk about the Cirrus, and because our club lost our Cirrus SR-20 maybe 18 months ago. I mean, they didn't lose it. They know where it went. It's just we didn't have it available anymore. And we've got another one now, and I went out and checked out on it yesterday, and I went, oh, yeah, right. I remember why I like this airplane. So even the 20, I mean, which is the 200 horsepower one, is really nice. And Max T, let me throw you a real quick question. You ever operated with an Aztec 30 autopilot?
I have. It's been a long time. That's the one that doesn't have altitude hold. It's just lateral modes, no up, down.
Yeah, and the whole display looks really weird. But anyway, it was I'd never run one of those before, so it was quite interesting. But so still a lot of fun.
That sounds like an early Cirrus. So what, 2002, 2001, something like that?
Call. Oh, this guy knows his airplanes. 2002, it is. Wow. All right. Can you guess the serial number? Okay, never mind.
Yeah, serial two or three. Yeah, it's pretty early on.
All right, Max, what's up with you?
Oh, I was at a wonderful dinner banquet on Saturday in which I was honored, so that was kind of fun. The National Aeronautics Association, the NAA, has presented me with an award there. That was not the biggest award that was given out. The biggest award was the Crystal Eagle, which was given to John and Martha King for their many years of service as educators to aviation. They've sold more than a million videos and online courses and things like that. But NAA recognized me for dedicating 16 years to aviation safety and education as a flight instructor, lecturer, author, podcaster, and past president of the Aero Club of Northern California. That was presented by the president of NAA, who flew out from Washington to present that. So that was kind of fun.
Wow. Congratulations.
Hey, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. Congratulations, you.
Did you get any pictures?
Yeah, there's a picture of me with John and Martha.
So, what a surprise.
That was kind of fun. Yeah, they are wonderful people. I've met them both before, and they gave a fun presentation with their typical humor, so it was kind of fun.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's how they afford their Falcon is selling those million-plus videos and CDs and online courses.
Yep.
Yeah, so Max T, I guess you didn't get any for free then.
Oh, any free videos?
Yeah. The training from them.
Oh, for free flights in the Falcon. Okay, no.
Yeah, I think Max is sort of beyond the need for videos at this point.
That's right. I've moved on to CDs.
No, that's not what I meant.
We're never too old to learn.
Well, that's right. True. Brian, what's new with you?
The holidays have kept me firmly planted on the ground, but my mom came out to visit and kind of have an interesting LAX security story. So my mom being relatively old and not very mobile, I wanted to ensure that she got to the club and out to the gate and actually left. So I wanted to accompany her through security. And when she went to check in and check her suitcase in, I asked for a pass to go through security, and they said no. And I said, okay, well, can we ask a supervisor about this? I'm not really a security risk. I should be able to go with her. And the security or the supervisor comes over and says, well, no, we won't do passes for passengers. I said, okay, but I can go online right now, buy a ticket for later on this evening, a fully refundable ticket, and then you'll issue me a boarding pass so I could get through security. And they said, yeah, we'll do that.
Like, of
you
course.
Guys are just insane. I don't understand where the security is and why they wouldn't just give me a pass to go. The supervisor also said that had I been with a minor, not even an unaccompanied minor, but just if I was with a minor, they would have given me a pass to take the minor through. I said, what's the difference between my 80-some-year-old mother, who has mobility issues and all, versus a child. It's like the whole thing just doesn't make sense to me. And the fact that they're willing to go through the effort of selling a refundable ticket to get around the problem just seems crazy. So.
Well, that kind of shows you that it's not a security issue. It's a United bureaucracy issue. And whether it's accurate,
I didn't say it was United, but
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
You didn't really do that, Rob, did you?
And that's why
did that.
And so we know it's a probably not a security issue, but it could be a airline's bureaucracy issue.
Yeah.
Is it really the airline or is it the, the TSA?
I think that it's the airline that's making that decision.
Yeah, I do too.
You think the airline, so the rule that only passengers, through security is an airline rule? I thought it was a TSA rule.
I don't know, maybe.
Because I don't see any variation across different airlines.
Yeah, but the thing, to circumvent it, it's quite easy.
Well, yeah, you go to the airline to circumvent it. But I think the rule is a TSA rule.
Okay.
So that's who you ought to complain to. So good luck with that.
No, I'll just buy a refundable ticket and then.
Well, that's the way it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, as long as I guess I don't do it on a weekly basis with the same airline, that's not.
They might not like that.
Yeah, they might not like that, yeah. But. Just crazy.
I don't know. I'm still not convinced about that being TSA. I mean, if they were so focused on security, I can't believe even they are that stupid that they couldn't see the workaround that Brian just explained. I mean, that's kind of...
Maybe one of our listeners knows more.
Someone knows true. More.
Hey, yeah. What happened to TSA Bob? Remember him? We used to talk to him.
We did. Gosh, it's been a long time.
I wonder if he's still around.
It's a good question.
TSA Bob, if you're there, reach out. We'd love to know.
Write us. Okay, let's move on to positive airline story of the week. What BCAS? What's that all about?
Yeah, to make everyone happy, I was thinking about renaming this segment to Brian's Commercial Aircraft Segment or Aviation Segment. Yeah, BCAS.
All right, so here's this week's BCAS segment.
I was just wondering if that would make everyone else happy, if instead of just positive airline story, it's my...
You won't make everyone else happy. There's no way to make everyone else happy. But all right, so you've got a great story. This is actually nice. This is from the Daily Mail?
Yeah, from the Daily Mail. A guy by the name of Joe Dowd, unfortunately, in 2014, suffered a brain aneurysm. And his wife, Liz, wrote into... BA, and they apparently have a program called the Magic Campaign, and they kind of do something nice to people. And Joe was a very avid flyer and really missed flying as a result of his brain injury that he suffered through the aneurysm. So he was selected, which was really great. And BA came to his house, picked him up in a limo. He was doing his first flight, and he was going to go to Ireland, where apparently his relatives are. But it was nice being picked up in a Rolls-Royce limousine. He was admitted into the first-class lounge and enjoyed all the benefits of the first-class lounge. Pre-flight, he, of course, had special boarding. The captain invited him into the flight deck, which was kind of nice, then presented him with a certificate for a session in a simulator after he finished his trip. And on top of that, he either met his – I can't remember if he met his wife in Australia or they vacationed in Australia a lot. Regardless, BA also gave them two – first-class seats on a future flight to Sydney. And I just thought that it was really neat what BA did with their Magic Campaign to sort of reintroduce someone to flying and make this guy's really unfortunate situation turn out to be something really positive and really special.
Yeah, exactly. Here you've got a guy that suffers a brain aneurysm. Has this tragic experience. He almost miraculously overcomes some, really difficult things. And I don't think that his wife, when she wrote to BA, was, looking for something for nothing. I don't think it was that at all. But I think the story touched someone at FBA, and they responded in this way. And yeah, that's what I call, yeah, being nice or being human.
Well, yes and no. I mean, BA does have the magic campaign where people write in, and I'm not sure if they're specifically asking for something or if it's just tell us your story and BA as an airline will do something nice if you're selected.
Hmm.
So I believe that's the way it worked. But regardless, it was truly something fantastic to get Joe back up in the air and, you know, treat him as a celebrity along the way. And I think they really went out of their way to make this a super special experience for him.
Very nice. And so we'll have a link to that dailymail.co.uk article in the show notes. Take a look at that. It's a nice story. And there's some video associated with it, too, as I recall.
Yes.
All right. One final item. This came from our pal, Mick, and he sent us some news. You might recall we talked about Thomas Hudner, at least an episode, I think it was 447, and a couple of episodes prior to that. This was the pilot that went through some really extraordinary measures to support another pilot that was shot down in North Korea during the Korean War. Hudner has apparently just recently died, and Mick sent along the citation. It's worth taking a look at. This says, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty as a pilot in Fighter Squadron 32 while attempting to rescue a squadron mate whose plane struck by anti-aircraft fire and trailing smoke was forced down behind enemy lines. Quickly maneuvering to circle the downed pilot and protect him from enemy troops infesting the area, Lieutenant Hudner risked his life to save the injured flyer who was trapped alive in the burning wreckage. Fully aware of the extreme danger in landing on the rough mountainous terrain, in the scant hope of escape or survival in sub-zero temperature, he put his plane down skillfully in a deliberate wheels-up landing in the presence of enemy troops. With his bare hands, he packed the fuselage with snow to keep the flames away from the pilot and struggled to pull him free. Unsuccessful in this, he returned to his crashed aircraft and radioed other airborne planes, requesting that a helicopter be dispatched with an axe and fire extinguisher. He then remained on the spot despite the continuing danger from enemy action, and with the assistance of the rescue pilot, renewed a desperate but unavailing battle against time, cold, and flames. Hudner's exceptionally valiant action and selfless devotion to a shipmate sustain and enhance the highest traditions of the U.S. Naval Service. The pilot that was downed was Jesse Brown. It had some notoriety himself in that he was a black pilot, was he the first naval aviator? Or
he was one of the first black naval aviators.
Yes, now. Yes.
It's also the plot of Bridges Over Toko Ri.
Oh, yes, that's right. I did find there's an article about this in Aerotech News. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. It says that, and this is really cool, it says that more than 800 family, friends, and active duty and retired service members gathered in Concord, Massachusetts, November 16th, to pay their final respects to retired Captain Thomas J. Hudner, Jr., who earned the Medal of Honor during the Korean War. He passed away November 13th at his home in Concord. He was 93. And you'll recall maybe that when we talked about this before, he actually traveled to North Korea in order to try to find the crash site and to see if there was anything there that could be recovered, but ultimately he was unsuccessful. But boy, you really got to give him a lot of credit for not forgetting and trying to do that. So we'll close with that. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest again was Daniel Baker. He's founder and CEO of FlightAware.com, and you can visit that website and learn a lot more about the services they offer, the products that they have. And if you want to participate in this network of ADS-B ground stations, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/479. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Any place that has Jetwine in the name, any place that has Flying Magazine in the name. And let me be the first to say happy Thanksgiving to all of those folks in the United States who will be listening. And to those in England, you probably don't care about this.
Okay. I don't know how many countries have Thanksgiving, but quite a number do, I think. But they're all at different times and maybe for different purposes, so... David Vanderhoof, tell us where we can find you online.
Over the next couple of weeks, I'll probably be offline given my move, but you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog that there should be a post up in the next day or so. And you can find me on the UAV Digest with that guy, Max Flight, on Friday mornings.
Great. And Brian Coleman, what about you?
Oh, I'm definitely thankful for you guys and all of our listeners. This is definitely one of the highlights of my week doing the show, and the feedback from the listeners, really appreciate it, both positive and negative. So keep it coming. Definitely like the positive stuff more than the negative, but negative's fine as well. But you are definitely appreciated. Finding me online is... I'm still not being social, sorry. Best way to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
You know, Brian, they've been talking about you in the Slack team.
Again?
Yeah, they're asking, when is Brian going to show up here? So get on the stick, dude.
Have you guys approved my Slack account yet,
by the way? You're in there.
Yes.
Because I never got a notice.
Yeah, you're there.
Oh, there's an excuse.
Yeah, forget it. I'm not buying it. All right.
You have mine, Brian.
Nobody's asked for... Oh, never mind.
Hey, I heard that.
Actually, that's not true. Max Trescott, how do folks find you?
Well, they can always find me at the Palo Alto Airport, where I will be flying with podcast listener Michael tomorrow while he's visiting here in the San Francisco area. And you can also find me at aviationnewstalk.com if you're at all into general aviation. And just click on contact and send me a message.
Wow. You know, that's such a good podcast. If I listened to all your episodes, would I just get a pilot's license for free?
You know, I kind of joke with a Cirrus pilot who often brings his girlfriend along, and she sits in the back, and I keep telling her, 10 more flights, and you'll have your license too.
Yeah, really.
And we also have to congratulate Max's airport for being a drone test center.
That's right, Trescott. Did you know that?
Oh, Palo Alto?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I did not know that. I know that I did spot something on our traffic a couple of weeks ago when I was in the aircraft, and I could tell by the altitude it was just hovering at 100 feet near Moffett Field, and I thought, oh, there's a drone.
There's a drone.
And you are now a test center to provide that information up to you as a pilot. So the next time someone's flying a drone in the area and calls the tower, I want to know if you actually heard from the tower or not.
Oh, good.
Because you're part of a national test site.
This is the Lance project, and there are a number of sort of pilot airports. The idea is that if you're a drone operator, that you'll have the ability to, through an app on your smartphone, notify the tower, get approval to fly in that airspace. So, yeah, it'd be really interesting to see if you see the results of that at all.
You know, and we also tried to get Palwaukee involved to drive certain people nuts, but the FAA said they're impossible to deal with at that airport. So
we've got our own problems. Well, I'll tell you, when I was out flying this weekend, the huge flocks of Canada geese that we saw at, roughly they fly at between 500 and 800 feet above the ground, just enormous dark, blot out the sun kind of flocks of geese. And so it's funny, but once I got on the ground, it made me realize that, one stinking drone isn't really that big a deal.
And by the way, I think it makes sense for us to be a test site. We have so much construction going on here in Silicon Valley. It is unbelievable. Facebook is working on buildings. Google has 6 construction cranes on one site. A pair of them, I think, are 190 feet. Some of the tallest construction cranes I've ever seen from the ground. You know, these aren't on top of a skyscraper. So, yeah, it's just building like crazy out here.
All right. Well, hey, let's finish the rest of the closeout. And then we could be done. So, okay, I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and with Mary Kirby at the PaxX Podcast. That's at PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. He's at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
Rocking ready to go. It's been one of those non-productive days. We have two new kittens who've been spending the last 24 hours behind the washer and the dryer, so we fished them out today.
Oh no.
Max.
Brian.
How are you?
Brian.
Max.
Max. It's like at the hospital. Doctor, 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 doctor. Maybe close to takeoff. So I guess they're getting new here.
David, what are you doing?
God, that hurts.
Yeah, blowing my eardrum out. That's what he's doing.
Exactly.
I'm trying to inhale my dinner after moving boxes all day long to be on this show. So, yeah, that's what I'm I'm trying to eat dinner before
our guest shows. Just let us know when you're done.
No, I just saw an announcement and didn't read further.
Well, that's not good. You're supposed to read further.
Not before I talk. I never research things before I talk. Sheesh.
Yeah, we know.
Uh-huh. I was going to say, that's glaringly obvious every week.
Rob, are you there?
Yeah.
All right. Who is that? Put Rob on. Get off.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry. Boy, that guy is so annoying, isn't
exactly.
he?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
You need a real professional radio guy like one of us, Max. I mean, that's why we're here, aren't we?
Rob, say hello to Daniel.
Hi there. I didn't know you were already on.
Hey, Rob. Nice to meet you.
All right. I'm wet, right?
That's right. Where are all you guys located?
I'm in Chicago. Okay.
Max Truscott, I'm out in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And Brian, I'm in Los Angeles.
All right.
And the other Max is in Connecticut.
All right. So you got the corners covered, huh?
We pretty much do.
We do. Yeah, we absolutely do. And there's
chopped
David.
Chopped livers in Philadelphia.
Chopped liver. Yeah. David,
still eating your dinner?
Yeah, have you finished yet, David?
I'm trying to inhale as fast as I can, guys. Really.
No, don't choke on our account. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So you're in the new apartment, David?
No.
No, you're
in the old apartment because you needed me to record tonight.
No. Oh. Where is all your stuff?
Most of my stuff is up in the new apartment.
Ah.
But the cable and the wireless internet is still in the old apartment.
So you had to go down to Essington tonight? That's a long haul.
It is what it is.
Thanks for doing that. I know that's.
I mean, I go out of my way for this show, and it's completely not appreciated. So, no worries.
Completely.
Thank you. All right, are you through now, David?